CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins. There's a shot of the sun coming through the clouds, and it's like the rays, or it looks like, you know, it looks like comes right off the Raisin Bran box. It's...
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins.
Hello, hello.
And today we have a very special guest. It's director Stephen Maxwell Johnson. His movie High Ground comes out on digital and on demand May 14th. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Nice to be with you all.
Yeah. I see that there are three people who were credited on the story here. So what was the inspiration for this story?
Essentially, look, I've had an incredible life where I've grown up in the Bahamas, Africa, and the Northern Territory. I spent most of my life living and playing with Indigenous people. I was adopted into the Yolngu families and have seen ceremony, been told so many stories, and my very best friends. So the whole idea has really come from within that relationship and all of those stories and things that I've seen. And Chris, the writer, is a very old friend of mine. He spent time in Arnhem Land with me. He's traveled right across. We sat in the dirt with the elders for 20 years, listening, and grappling with the idea of this story and how we could tell it and how we could put it out there. So it's been a very organic process. It's been a both ways collaborative process, bridging that thing between two cultures, two languages, many languages. In fact, there's several languages spoken in the film. And Widiana being a very, very powerful ceremonial leader in Arnhem Land who travels from east to west and right across, following the song lines and conducting ceremonies and being one of the wisest men out there, has deep connections right through all the families. And we really have just been on this kind of journey of creating and realizing this kind of truth-telling, really.
Mm-hmm. It's your story is set after World War One, right?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Yeah. What's going on in Australia at this point, and why is that the best moment to start this story?
Well, it wasn't. It's a good question. When you say best moment, we just thought that the whole thing we set out to do was okay. Great, we want to tell this epic untold story, but let's make it entertaining. Let's dramatically set it so that it's compelling, it's immersive, it's non-judgmental. Let's tell a balanced story. Let's look at it from two perspectives. Let's take the audience. Let's put them in the film and let's go on this journey together, this song line, so to speak. So, look, setting it after the First World War, a lot of white fellas, Ballander, came back to this country, as we all know, deeply traumatized through that experience. They struggled to fit into society. A lot of them came up to North Australia to get away from it. They took jobs with the police force. Various things, went on to country as cattlemen. And, there was a process of disbursement happening. I mean, black fellas were in the way as white fellas were expanding across the land, and it was about, you know, hunting buffalo, hunting crocodiles, hunting human beings. It was a moment of conflict, settlement. It was about conquest. There was even a police force here created, the Queensland Native Police, that was made up of blackfellas, and their mission was to disperse and actually kill countrymen. So there was a really quite a sickening part of our history where there was murder after murder after massacre taking place right across the land. And we've really just drawn our inspiration from true story, true characters of that time, and created a fiction, but history's fiction. But it was all about sort of dramatizing the story in that way to tell a deeper truth and to really try and, you know, create an entertaining film, as I say. So, but a film that had impact, had meaning, and had a, you know, something to kind of just put out there for people to rethink our story.
Yeah, and you have, I guess, a story that's going to hit home for a lot of people. I mean, the opening of this movie, which is 16 to 20 minutes long, there's a massacre that occurs with very little prompting. It's just devastating to watch all the way through. I'm assuming this is an all too common tale.
Correct. I mean, look, it's, you know, taken directly from real life events. And there was a particular massacre at a place called Gangan in northeast Arnhem Land, 1935. And the family members there are directly related to Widiana, who plays the old man in the film. So this is all a very, very immediate history. And the Indigenous players who'd never acted before in the film have direct connection to all those stories and a lot of that tragedy that is still in living memory and in the story. So it's really, they're telling their story. They're really putting their life out there and their connections out there. It's a beautiful thing to work with and to learn from and to grapple with, you know what I mean, as far as trying to sort of find the best way to sing the song, so to speak.
Yeah, I was going to ask about your casting process. I think you've maybe possibly answered about half of it, because you say that you've lived with these people before and you've been among them and everything. So I was kind of wondering how you got your performers from the Aborigines and everything.
I have a good understanding of a few languages. I've had a lifetime of learning and growing up with Yolngu and Binning people, and it's through that trust and those relationships that you know, I'm able to kind of move freely. Widiana's my best friend, the guy who plays the old man Tharpa. We had many, many years traveling the world and doing things together with a band he co-founded called Yacht the Yindi. You know, really we just spent an enormous amount of time traveling through country and looking for people to be in the film, and prior to that working with people creating the story. So, you know, all the families knew about this and were participating in the process of making a reality, because it's the long untold story. So yeah, it's an amazing process. And the beautiful, just a very quick little one, which I've mentioned a few times this morning in my other interviews, beautiful story about Jacob Junior Nyingel, the lead actor.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Who's excellent.
Extraordinary looking young man. Well, 25 years ago, I sat in the dirt in Kumbalanya with his grandfather, old man Jacob Nyingel, and a man called old man Bill Nagy, who are two very, very powerful elders from Western Arnhem Land, who helped establish Kakadu and were all about cultural survival and passing on knowledge and keeping all the dream stories alive. But during I spoke to them about the idea of telling the story of the resistance, and both of those men and their families and wives were all about, yes, access to country. We will go to all the special places to tell that story. We have to do it. Anyway, over the course of creating the film, both of those beautiful, important men passed away. Jacob Jr. was born. He grew up. And as I was out on country looking for the warrior who would play the part in this film, he came for a screen test. He put a spear to my neck and looked straight into my eyes, and basically I was gone. And it was his grandfather who had, who was one of the original people, great supporters of the idea of this film. So it's almost like he sung his grandson to me, which is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I was shocked to see that he had never been in a movie before. Like, watching the performance. Because, I mean, he's holding his own with, you know, Simon Baker, who's very established. Jack Thompson.
Yeah.
I mean, which I love that you had Jack Thompson in there, by the way, because it was, I mean, I know this is a very different movie than Breaker Morant, but it's hard not to think of that once this movie started. So it was really cool to see Jack Thompson come in.
Yeah, no, he really, really lands it, as does Simon. You know, both of those gentlemen and dear friends of mine have had a deep journey and have been very affected by the whole process of the making of the film. Simon's relationship with Jacob is extraordinary. Their real life relationship is, in a sense, playing out on the screen, that father-son thing. They're both learning and feeling each other out. Simon hadn't spent time in that country, in that world before. It's Jacob's country. He was at home. And there was kind of like this both ways thing happening on and off the screen. So there was this beautiful natural resonance to what's happening between the two of them. And it just works. And, you know, all credit to Simon. I think he's done an extraordinary job. And he handled and worked with Jacob so sensitively and in such a caring way that all just happens on the screen.
Absolutely. Does Jacob have aspirations to continue with this?
He does. He does. And we were here in Darwin. He had some film awards here the other night called the Capricorn Awards, and he won Best Actor.
Oh, that's awesome.
And to get him, I could hardly get him in the car the next day. His smile was so big to get him to drive him the 400 kilometers back to his community. But his family had been on the phone crying all night long. Aww. And he was telling them, look, you mob, you've got to get yourselves together. Stop crying. And they're going, oh, we can't. You're like that Men in Black man. Now you're a big movie star, because he wore a black tuxedo to the awards. He was the only one in a black tuxedo, and he just rocked.
That is so awesome to hear. Yeah. I can't. I hope he continues, because this guy is an absolute find.
Yeah. And you would know who David Gorpilil is. He's another very famous Aboriginal actor, been in so many big Australian films, but he's very ill now and hasn't got too much longer to live. But there was a big award ceremony in Adelaide not too long ago, and he sort of passed the mantle across to Jacob and sort of said, it's your journey now, which is very, very beautiful.
You know, that's so awesome.
Yeah, very beautiful.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Speaking of very beautiful, this movie looks amazing. I wanted to know about your collaboration with your cinematographer and how you guys achieved the look of the film.
Sure.
You guys can talk about some nerdy, stuff like aspect ratios and all that type of stuff too, if you want to.
That's good. Good question. So look, straight into it. I mean, really, it's about perspective. And my early conversations with Andy were all about, you know, I've grown up being a cinematographer in Arnhem Land most of my life. And it's about trying to see the world from a Yolngu perspective, which means you're not outside it, you're in it. You're participating in the movement of it, whether it's human, whether it's animal, whether it's tree. You're hearing as well as seeing. Aspect ratio, yes, I always wanted to do it in this division, because you're dealing with height, you're dealing with width, but you are, in a sense, it's more connected to what the human eye sees. So, you know, we don't see the world in CinemaScope. So if you think about what you see as you look forwards, bang, it's about trying to get that perspective on things and actually to allow your eye to move around and see things and think things and respond to things that you kind of almost do subconsciously. So that's a Yolngu way of seeing the world and being part of it. And that was really the starting point. It was about saying, Andy, this is what we want to do. We want to go high. We want to go low. We want to fly like the hawk. We want to see that world and feel that world. The camera can never be still. It needs to be moving. It's a living thing. And hopefully that all sort of helps in that idea of immersing and being on country and physically sort of being in the story.
I mean, it's incredible. I think there are countless shots in here that I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. You guys like just either got, I mean, I don't know how lucky you got. I mean, there's a lot of skill obviously, but one shot in particular stood out to me, and it's when, and I'm sorry. I Jacob plays, he has his, they give him an English name of Tommy, but I didn't quite catch what his native name
was. Gutjuk, which is Gutjuk, G-U-T-J-U-K, Gutjuk. And it's a Yolngu a skin name, Totanic name, that is the name of the hawk.
Yeah.
The whole dreaming story that goes with that, and that's his connection. That's his kind of life force.
When he and Travis and Eddie and Walter, and we also the Callan Mulvey is also awesome.
Yeah, isn't he awesome? Yeah.
Yeah. When they have that standoff somewhere in the middle of the film, somewhere beginning middle of the film.
Yeah.
There's a shot of the sun coming through the clouds. And it's like the rays, or it looks like, you know, it looks like comes right off the Raisin Bran box. It's unbelievable. Like, did you just get super lucky with that? Or is this just, I don't know, man.
Well, no, that's good, man. I'm loving all this because, look, of course, lucky. But I'm not bullshitting here. The thing about Yolngu and Binning people, they have an incredible connection to country and reading the land and being able to speak and sing about everything that is life. And a lot of the locations we went into, an elder would sing us in or talk us in and introduce the crew to the ancestors for that particular site and that area, because there were places that have never been filmed on before that are very special places that they wanted us to, you know, we worked together and we wanted to film on. So there's this beautiful process of connecting with the country and the environment as we were making the film. It was part of the journey. And I truly believed time and time again that things just came together. Clouds seemed to dance in our favor. Things seemed to sort of, the wind seemed to blow in our favor. Birds would appear when we wanted them to. Crocodiles were kind of behaving themselves. It was an amazing sort of collaboration on all levels, and you really felt that because there's this, you know, there's these old men and old women on set with us every day, and it's their country. It's where they have lived for thousands and thousands of years. It's who they are. It's not like this is our land, we live on it. It's they're part of it. They're so connected, and it's all one. And to just be working with that living culture all around you is very, very special. And you kind of feel everything's in harmony and things are flowing, even though the filmmaking process is chaotic, it's fast, you know, you're trying to meet your schedule, we never have enough money, it's all that shit. It's still this beautiful calmness and kind of like, you know, I keep bringing us back this idea of the song line. We were on a sort of a song line, a kind of dreaming track during the making of the film with great people guiding us and standing next to us every step of the way. And that there was a beautiful energy to the process.
Yeah.
How many days did you have? How many days did you shoot?
7 weeks. Yeah.
7 weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Not very long.
No, and you're on location, no. And I mean, that's got to be hectic.
Very, very, very remote part of the world. You know, only way in some places, helicopter, four-wheel drive, always crossing river systems that you could only cross at certain times of the day because they're tidal. They're also infested with 5-meter crocodiles.
Oh, my God.
Trying to get horses and cattle on that country. are creatures that are just meant to be eaten by crocodiles. They can smell them from 5 miles away. So, you know, you're working in a sense, a dangerous environment, but it's wild, it's real. And again, though, bringing you back to the old men and the women who know the law, they know what you can do and what you don't do. You just work with it. You go with the flow and you kind of sit in with nature and it can happen.
You may have mentioned this before, but where exactly was the shot?
Western Arnhem Land. So you may have heard of a place in Australia called Kakadu. It's quite a famous park that was set up on the western side of the East Alligator River. It's called the Alligator River because those white fellas back then didn't realize they're crocodiles, but that's
I was actually wondering about that when it came up on the screen. Yeah, I was like, why is it called alligator?
It's kind of another ignorance that happened, but it's still there. Kind of works. And then the other side of the East Alligator River, which is Western Arnhem Land, which is Arnhem Land. So it's a protected area where Binning people have, you know, lived and had tenure for land for tens and tens and tens and tens of thousands of years. And that's the country and where the story is set. And that's where a lot of the cast came from too. It's their country. So there's, you know, that beautiful connection to all of that.
Yeah.
Very cool.
In getting back into some nerdy stuff, there's one particular scene that I love where you've staged it in such a way, it's with the grandfather and Moran, where they had the negotiation,
meeting. Yeah.
The meeting. And it starts off the way the photograph is staged. First off, tells you a lot, I think, about the difference in the cultures immediately. Because he's the main part of that photograph on the right side of the screen, on the right side of the photo. Meanwhile, the tribe is always together. There's no separation. And when it comes to the point of the meeting, you know, everybody in the tribe is just there. They're together. There's not, you know, we know who the leader is, but there doesn't seem to be any sort of superiority type of thing going on there. But meanwhile, Moran has got this, he's just sitting essentially by himself. There are people behind him, but everybody's just scattered around and everything. What was your idea behind all of that?
Well, it was really, you know, after sort of speaking to old men and for years about the idea of these kind of this missed opportunity, these disconnections that took place. I mean, you've got to remember that there was this whole notion of terra nullius here, where it's empty land, humans didn't exist. You know, there was flora and fauna. Aboriginal people weren't even recognized. We weren't even citizens of this country till the 70s. It's an absolute disgrace what took place. So this kind of whole lack of recognition that there's, you know, there are even human beings for a start. But the idea is obviously theirs to see this divide, to see this separation, this ignorance, this kind of misunderstanding, the language problems, the mistakes and misunderstandings that happened on both sides. And, you know, that kind of idea of not wanting to listen, not wanting to learn, not really, really being open or vulnerable to any other perspective than that of conquest. It was just really trying to give an honest portrayal of how some of those meetings would have played out and what was taking place. And, you know, Jack just finds a beautiful space with Widianna's there with his authority and his connection. And it's, you know, we there was a little improvised line that came into that about the badge on his you can think he's boss. That kind of happened on the day. And that was beautiful because it was Jacob's reaction, because he doesn't have a great command of English. He speaks Gunwinku, Widianna speaks Rirratjingu. So there were several different Aboriginal languages being spoken at that meeting as well, which is how it was back in the day. Many clans and tribes would come together and be able to to speak each other's language. That's not so much the case now. So we had to kind of navigate that space between Whitiana and Jacob, because they're actually speaking to each other in different tongues. And in real life, they don't actually understand each other. So that was a beautiful process of relearning language between those two. And then, you know, just and it's interesting because there's just such a disconnection just in language itself about how things are spoken. So Jack kept pointing at the badge, and it wasn't in the script as such, and it was just like, well, Jacob, what do you think about that? And he just came up with that line. That's exactly what he thought about it. And it was just like, well, that's exactly what took place back in the day. That kind of says it all. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. There's this assumption, yeah. And, I think it's a very special scene, that one.
It is. It gets at the root of a conflict in a way that you can feel the frustrations and the tragedy of it and everything. When he goes to this meeting, he's expecting to be talking to the boss, yeah. and he's not really talking to the boss there. No. That's what's so, insane about it. Like, this person isn't going to be able to get you what you want. You have to speak to somebody who's, you know, however many kilometers away I really, really did love that scene. I could see that you spent a lot of time on it. So,
tricky one.
Tell me the significance of High Ground in this movie.
That's another good question. The working title for the film for many years was Resistance. However, that was never going to really stick. It was all too much about saying too much, trying too hard, and there's other films called Resistance, and it's just we never wanted to sort of brand the film in any particular way. But we just found through the perspective of the hawk, through the way songlines travel, creative beings went across the land. We think about the moral high ground. The word high ground became something that was spoken in the story. You take the high ground, you see, and that works from both sides. And it was just there, sort of embedded in the script, and it was something that was spoken a few times in the story. And it was just like, whoa, okay, hang on. There it is. There's the title of the film. It says so much about what's going on in so many ways, thematically within the story. And it kind of stuck. And, it had sort of a commercial tone about it. It was always about creating an entertaining film and putting something out there, you know, that was kind of accessible to the wider audience. I mean, at one stage you thought, do we call it Gutjuk? Do we call it a indigenous name? But no, it was all just, we don't need to try that hard. Let's just let this sit. Let's just keep things accessible, keep it simple. Let's not be judgmental in any way. And High Ground just kind of seems to play.
Mm-hmm. Obviously there's the literal moment where Simon Baker, Travis is discussing what it means to have high ground and everything. And then he tries to discuss high ground with another, and I'm sorry, is it a tribal name? What's the tribe's name?
So when you say tribe, who are you talking about? You mean?
I'm sorry. I don't have the right terms.
That's okay. So which scene? So Travis is talking with
again, I'm going to butcher this name. Gutjuk. He's with a woman in this one scene, and he's trying to repeat back what Travis.
No, you're talking about the cave scene at night.
Yes.
Great. All right. There you go. Sorry, Matt. Beautiful scene because those two characters in the story, in a sense, are poison skin. So in the kinship system, they can't really be together. And in real life, they they don't really speak to each other in real life. That's Jacob and Esmeralda, who play Gulwari and Goodjook. Yeah, the underplayed love story. Oh yeah, gotcha. Okay, good. So what actually? There's a lovely story there because the elders gave permission for those two young people to be in those scenes together and to do what they did because they're kind of like a. In real life, they're like a prince and a princess when it comes to the estates and the families that they're from. They're kind of royalty in their own way. And the elders really just thought it was very appropriate that they got to work together because there's a powerful kind of energy flowing between them. Even mm-hmm. though in real life they barely talk, they're not really supposed to look at each other and what have you. So to get those two people to do that scene was extraordinary. And they themselves really wanted to do this and felt that, you know, they wanted to take that challenge and kind of cross that boundary and tell this story. And I think that's all part of the power in those looks that's going on between those two is because they're kind of breaking a bit of sacred space, not only on the screen, but in real life as well, which is kind of awesome.
Yeah, it's really awesome. Is that something that is mentioned in the film? If in any way,
No. Look.
Oh my God! It makes that scene so much better to know that.
Yeah. No. Look, it's kind of like unspoken. I mean, when they're walking through the bush initially, you know, we hope we get the sense that this, you know, Baywa and his warriors are made up of, you know, displaced people from various places. Again, we didn't want to spell too much out. We didn't want to overcomplicate things. We want people to kind of fall into it and hopefully be affected by the looks, the relationships, the feelings that you just got through body and looking and stuff and allow that to inform rather than overstate things. So there's a lot of deliberate decisions made there. We, you know, to just less is better, we thought.
Yeah.
We never wanted to try and push that stuff too hard. And that's kind of how it is in real life too. It just sort of flows and you look at things and see things and you're affected by things. And we wanted the film to work in those ways. And I think, you know, okay, I've told you that now, but I'd like to think you felt that tension. There was an electricity there between those two people. And that's the way, you know, I chose to play that. And it works well.
I just like the contrast too, just from after Travis tells him about what high ground is and then he tries to repeat it back, she says, you're trying to act like the white man and you're never going to be in that position.
Right. Yeah, no, she's hard. She's hard, but she also softens and it's a beautiful romance. You kind of want more after they've walked off on the horse together.
Yeah, for sure.
No, she's an extraordinary young lady, Esmeralda, and just stepped up and delivered.
I always ask this of directors, but what was your hardest day on set?
Hardest day on set.
I would think avoiding the crocodiles. That would be mine.
Not really. Look, I've grown up with crocodiles in my life, and we had two shooters on set every day. We were near water, and if anything had got out of hand, they'd be finished up. But those crocodiles. That big, they're wise, and there were old men singing on country before we would shoot some days. They knew to stick their head up and keep out of the well, out of the way. They knew go doing the wrong thing around white fellas or you get shot. Man. I mean, they know when to pick their moment. Don't worry, you'll never see them coming. But no, so they weren't really a problem for us because of that kind of reading and understanding of those creatures with the with the people we're working with. It was more about just the heat every day was relentless. I mean, it was the build up time. They have six seasons in Arnhem Land, and it's the time when it's the thunder clouds are gathering, and it's Bulung, and it's the build up period, and it's hot, it's sweaty, it's humid. It's dry, and working in remote places with all those kind of natural elements coming at you was really every day. So, but no, look, I didn't. There wasn't not any Look, there were, you know, the horses bolted because there were, you know, big snakes in the grass, and there was dangerous moments with the horses, and Simon, you know, nearly got hurt one day because of this pack horse bolting, and if the reins had got around his leg, it might have been, you know, no more Simon there for a while. But, you know, things didn't go that way, and, you know, we had amazing horsemen on set, and things were, you know, all kept under control ultimately. But things did go wrong. I think probably one of the most challenging days for me just emotionally was just dealing with some of that, the massacre stuff.
Because of
where we set that in a very, very sacred waterhole called Gunlom, and just knowing the stories of that place and knowing the elders and the, you know, what we were doing in such a beautiful place. I find that, found that a very emotional thing to do, because I wanted to try and just not turn it into a bloodbath, but to try and sensitively deal with that horror and, you know, use sound and picture and try and find a really good balance to, yes, it needed to be harrowing, needed to be fucking visceral and hard and all that, but not to overplay it, not to just indulge myself in the blood. It was about trying to sort of balance that in a way that it was potent, but you could kind of let it go into you in a way. You know, it's fixed. I hope you know what I'm saying there. It could have very easily just been bang, kill, but it was about trying to really be in that moment, in that beautiful place, and finding that balance between how it would have been. You know, there's other creatures around, there's other sounds, there's just shock, there's horror, there's so much at play, and just trying to sort of be there with what that might have been like.
Jonathan, do you have anything?
Well, I mean, I was curious. I'm always curious when you're, you know, a time period is it, you know, at play with when the movie set. And I mean, you obviously didn't really have to, you were in remote, so you didn't have to deal with like automobiles and phones and stuff like that. But was there anything challenging about the fact that it was set in the 30s? And I mean, was it just mostly costuming or?
Yeah, look, I mean, well, look, that's there you go. That's a good one, because what was really important to us was to make sure that culturally everything that is in the film, from the stone spear tips to the necklace that adorns Gulbury's neck around the girl's neck, to everything that is worn and everything that is seen, it was all woven for the film. All the weaving was correct from the particular regions and the country that the film is shown. The stone spears took years and years and years to find in sacred quarries and to collect. And there's an incredibly beautiful story that around the Nambi, that the spear tips and where they're from, and only very, very special places. And sourcing all of those things, creating all of those things, was a big challenge, because a lot of that knowledge is disappearing. And the old people who know the particular weaves, or, for example, how to make that necklace. It took me 3-4 years to find an old woman who knew how to actually make that necklace and what it was made of, because it was from a photo that was taken back in the 20s by a guy called Baldwin Spencer. And I just, no one, was it Fishbones? Was it this? Was it that? But there was this one old woman out in the middle of Arnhem Land when I was there casting one day, and I was talking to her about this necklace. She said, show me photo. So I showed her the photo. She said, that one. And she knew exactly what it was made of. And it was made of the tips of buffalo grass, this particular spear grass that grows in Arnhem Land, that's harvested at a particular part of its life cycle and then very lightly dried with fire and sun. And it just goes rock hard, and it's cut up, and, you know, obviously it was made into this necklace. But, you know, how to do that, how to make that, when to pick that, was just something that isn't known that well anymore. And that was the case with quite a lot of things. And so we often found these beautiful scenes where we had old people making these things for the film, just surrounded by young people, just looking and learning and kind of being part of that whole process. It was like cultural revival in a sense. It was really special. And the old people knew that was going to be part of the journey of making this film, because we all needed to dig deep into things culturally in order to tell this story. And that was could only be a good thing.
That is fascinating.
Oh my gosh. Well, this is an amazing movie. I hope a lot of people, go out and find it. It's an incredible story. We'd like to thank Stephen Maxwell Johnson for giving us his time. Thank you so much for coming on today, sir.
Absolutely. Oh, look, gentlemen, can I say absolute pleasure to share this with you and just to kind of have the opportunity for, the families, myself, to be putting this story out there and in America. And, wow, I mean, what a time we live in post-COVID. The stuff that's going on over there at the moment in the light of, all the troubles and stuff. Maybe people are just a little bit more vulnerable and open-hearted now to take a big, long think about the human story. And we're very lucky here. We've got the oldest human story on Earth through this culture that we have in Australia. And it's a part of who we all are. And we just all need to look out for each other a bit better.
No doubt.
It applies to all of us everywhere.
Thank you so much for sharing. The movie is High Ground. It comes out digital and on demand May 14th. That's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkinson and Jonathan Watkins. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.